Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
To see America through the eyes of Black people is to see what America truly is, good and bad.
If we must be Americans, let us be consistent. You cannot thank Rosa Parks for sitting down, then tell Kaepernick to stand up.
You're going to relegate my history to a month? Oh, come on. What do you do with yours? Which month is White History Month? Well, come on.
We fight for freedom and justice every day.
Simply by being ourselves.
We are the ones living Black history.
The powers that be in the past several centuries did not want you to think about those stories.
Knowing your roots and where you come from is also key. Keep that with you always.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. And February is upon us, which means that it's time for Black History Month, which honestly has always been kind of a weird thing for me for reasons I've never really been able to fully articulate. I mean, I love learning the history of my community, to be clear, and I have always truly loved it. I can remember being as young as like sixth grade, pulling these big tomes down from my dad's library and just trying to copy him, honestly, by spending my weekends reading about stuff like the legal strategy of the civil rights movement at sixth grade. And yet, come February, I would roll my eyes, and I couldn't even really tell you why. Of course, now I host a show about history, and I get to call up all kinds of smart people to help me learn things. So, over the next few shows, I'm going to try to understand why I've never really embraced Black History Month, and if there's a future version of it that I can embrace. To start this journey, I'm joined by our senior producer, Verilyn Williams. Hey, Verilyn.
Hi, Kai.
So having outed myself as the Grinch of Black History Month, I turn to you because you are kind of just the opposite, right? Like you fully and without reservation embrace this annual ritual.
Yep. I love it. I actually celebrate it, all that good stuff.
And so why? What is it about this month that brings you so much joy?
Well, to quote a one Nina Simone, I have no choice. Like, to me, we are the most beautiful creatures in the world. And I get exciting knowing that from history, we always have been. And February is really just a national excuse to be intentional about following the lead of Black women like Nina Simone, who unapologetically center Blackness in their art and activism. Women like Oprah, who had me glued to my TV. Do you remember this? In 2006, watching her honor the contributions of Black people, Black legends at a ball.
And, you know, we must name one of those legends, Cicely Tyson, who just passed at the age of 96. She is exactly the kind of person who comes up around Black History Month, to your point, and in part because she played these roles, right? She was in Roots, and she was in the autobiography of Jane Pittman, these movies that told the story of our community's history. And here's something she said about her career in an interview with Gayle King that aired on CBS This Morning just a few days before she died.
A reporter said to you that he felt a bit of bigotry in himself while he was watching the movie. When I asked him why so, he said, I was uncomfortable about your older son referring to his father as daddy. I said, do you have children? What do they call you? He said, they call me daddy. And I thought, my God, this man is thinking that were not human beings. And I made up my mind that I could not afford the luxury of just being an actress, and that I would use my career as my platform.
What a legend. Right. And what really makes me emotional about Miss Tyson is that she dedicated her whole life to being a representation for what is possible for all of us, right? And I'm so grateful as we watch the tributes come in and all the tributes of years past that we were able to honor her and give her her flowers while she was here, you know?
Right, right. In real time.
In real time.
Well, okay, so you said you actually celebrate Black History Month as a kind of holiday. And by celebrate, we should point out that I mean you actually throw a party every year.
Yes, a party. With Black people and other folks too. And since, you know, for a lot of reasons this year, I won't be able to because we're still in a pandemic. I got some friends who have been to my parties of past to kind of recreate it a little. And we talk about Black History Month, what it means to us, what it means to them specifically. And I thought, you know, to do that, to kind of help you out, Kai.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it. So let's drop in on Vera Lynn's Black History Month party. Take a listen.
Hi.
What up?
So I have gathered us all today here because normally around this time, I'd be like, oh, when am I going to have this Black History party? I'm like texting Tracy, like, when are you free? Like just trying to get some kind of quorum to have a date for this party. And this time I did that to have you all here. So, hi. And also some of you I haven't seen. I don't know. James, I don't even know when the last time I saw you.
Man, I have no idea.
I was going to say, most of y'all, I don't think I've seen
all of you since Verilyn's Black History party last year.
Oh my God.
It's been a while. It's been a while.
Wow. Wow. And so I was super curious when I was thinking about this, like, if not for my parties, would you be celebrating Black History Month?
Yeah, I mostly as a result of having a kid, like one of the best things about Black History Month with her is that she has Black History Month programs. She went to an Afrocentric school, and the Black History Month program at her school was always so popping. Like, And just going to that was a lot of community because kind of everybody is there. We all go eat after. And it's just like a really, really, really good experience.
That's so interesting because I really do think it's almost like a kid holiday in that way. Because like not since I was in school and I had to do like a Black History Month report or I had to like memorize a Maya Angelou poem or something like that. I wasn't really out here, you know, doing a Black History. I was just like enduring Black History Month, if anything, and being pissed off that it's only 28 days, 29 every leap year.
Yeah, like I feel similar, and I've never really done anything to celebrate it even, besides like buying some like Black History Month pair of Kyrie Irving's basketball shoes, which I have right behind me. But the only time I really feel engaged with Black History Month is like when I feel like it may be threatened somehow, where somebody's like talking shit about Black History Month, or like somebody's like trying to like take it away. Then I'm like, wait, hold on. What do you mean? And I feel like that's when I'm like, nah, this is like something sacred. Mm.
You're defending it because it's about our ability to exist in white spaces.
Yeah.
And I think what I liked about the parties is like, it wasn't about white people at all.
Yeah. Like,
like not even a little bit.
30 seconds on time.
And even when we played games at your parties about Black history and identifying different people from Black history, it's like some people I'd never heard of. Like, and that was dope, like to like be introduced to Black people, you know, who did amazing things that I just had never been introduced to. Because I think part of my not having a really strong relationship to Black History Month is because I was like, oh, we're going to learn about the same we learned about last year.
The one defense I will say I've learned about the same folks over and over again, the McDonald's 365 Black campaign.
365 Black McDonald's.
365 Black because Black.
Like, they used to have some prime content. Then, like, radio commercials they would have where it would be the same. It was always, like, Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks. But it was always designed really nice. It would come on. It would be, like, a little music jingle.
And then brought to you by McDonald's.
And you know what? Hey, it's, we all have complicated relationships to capitalism. But I appreciated the effort. And then I always liked hearing those. Like, I was like, oh, right. It's Black History Month. Like, we in this. Everybody's got to do it. Everybody's got to show up a little bit.
Right.
It's like the same vibe as like back to school.
Yeah.
Vibes. Yeah. Because I think like my relationship with the month is like, I look at it almost as like a form of just like reassessing like my Blackness. And it's like kind of like a calendar year reminder, just like, you know, Christmas is like, you think about, you know, giving, and like Thanksgiving, you think about thanks. It's like February, I like reassess like my Blackness, and it's almost like a Black hygiene as far as looking like, how am I supporting like my Blackness? It's almost like a Blackness annual report.
Yeah. That is what it feels like for me, at least.
Like, it's like, what does it mean to radically think about like your time? And like, be like, how many minutes of my day or my time is being dedicated to like serving Blackness?
My next beat is that I wanted to like talk about specific memories from like Black History parties.
For me, it's just like the duck out conversations. It's like, I don't know, every time somebody came through the door, I ended up hugging. I was like, you know, like, it's just that, like, that embrace, that, you know, that like touch, the community is like, I mean, that's powerful.
I can grow. You just hug so many people at Marilyn's house.
Yes.
And I'm not even a hugger.
I'm not either. Don't touch me.
I remember hugging you, Eric. I remember coming in late. I literally remember that embrace.
And I feel each one of those. Yes. You know what I'm saying? Like, yes. It's the comfort. The comfort.
Yeah. I remember bringing Popeyes to your house, Marilyn. And there was already Popeyes there. And I love that. Like, two different people had the same thought.
The thing I'm remembering now that I really appreciate after this conversation is that we play all kinds of like Black music from like the 2000s, the 90s, and everybody was rocking because like we all knew that. But also we played Afro beats and everybody was still rocking. Even people didn't even know it. And like, I love.
This was before Black Panther.
Exactly.
Before Black Panther, when it was like cool.
So like, to have everybody vibing out to different Afro beat songs at your parties made it feel, I think it made me feel more included, that my sort of, I wasn't born in America. I'm not from America. I'm an immigrant. So I think I felt more included in this idea of Black History Month when we play Afro beats and everybody was jamming along with it.
The memory that I think about, and like, I literally, it's almost like a drug, like, you know how, like, I could only imagine because I've never done, like, coke or anything. But, like, they always say, like, that high, that first high, you can never get it back, right? So the high that I've been chasing ever since the first time I did this party was a moment where I remember just, like, everyone was, like, in their corners talking. And then... the beat for Nuck If You Buck started.
I knew you were going to say that.
And like, everybody came from their quarters and like, yeah, was on the middle of the kitchen. And it was like, yeah, we knuck it. And like, everyone screaming at the top of their lungs. It was just everyone just like jamming to this like ratchet, yeah, like Black anthem. And everyone knowing the words.
I remember that because it wasn't just like the music and how that song always unifies Black people because it's, you know, our unofficial Black anthem. But it's also, I think, the physicality of it. Like, yeah, it just, like, it felt so cathartic to just kind of just, I don't, like a good angry. Like, you know when you feel turnt?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's not anger, but it's just, like, turntness. And it's cathartic.
You're just,
to
like, pumped
that
up.
Through
you're
your
like...
body. And to, like, have that energy reverberate off of all the other Black bodies in the room. And it's just, it's like a... Like, how do I do this non-sexually?
we had a shared experience of release and ecstasy. How about that?
It was a release valve.
Yeah. Nuck If You Buck is a release valve.
But I think that song works like that just because, like, it's normally not okay for us to, like, express that type of energy in mass like that consistently. Like, that's going to freak somebody out. The police going to come. Yeah. And we're going to have to answer some questions. So, like, you know, in those spaces, like, yeah, you know, we could be a little angry. I'm not trying to hit nobody. But, like, somebody pissed me off today. And, you know, and I feel that. And somebody pissed you off today.
Yep. Yeah. I was brought up in a lot of white spaces. And I actually remember, I'm just now realizing I felt this way, like, hindsight. But being one of the only Black kids all these white kids, I remember being like cringe, like kind of cringy internal eye rolls, because it's like, okay, now y'all want to talk about Rosa Parks, now y'all want to, and then people turn to me like, oh my god, Zakiya, blah, blah. Zakiya, you should play Rosa Parks. Zakiya, you should play We Shall Overcome the Bells, which I did. And like, I'm not mad to do it, but I remember it made me feel like an other. It was kind of weird for me, because celebrating in these white spaces, and especially coming from a household that's super black, like, you know, all of us, me and my siblings, all have African names. I'm very Afrocentric. My middle name is Rosa after Rosa Parks. Just having that be normal in my household, and then go to a white space and be like, oh, we're doing this now. It was strange, to say the least.
Zakiya said, I'm steeped in the blood of my ancestors. She said, it flows through me everywhere.
Right. I'm like, I'm actually about that life. I think that's what felt strange. I'm like, I usually feel very proud about my blackness and down to talk about it, but not with y'all. Not the way y'all want to do it.
Yeah.
Which is why I appreciate your parties, because it's like, okay, by the people, for the people. We don't have to like focus on our trauma or talk about like the same five civil rights leaders, like, of course, all respect. But it's just like, it feels so packaged and just like, I don't know, spiritless, which is the opposite of black people. And your party was just so spiritful.
That was Eric Eddings, James T. Green, Saeed Tijan Thomas, Tracy Hunt, and Zakiya Gibbons, with our senior producer, Fairlyn Williams. And that last thing that Zakiya said, I think that's got something to do with my own weird feelings about Black History Month. The fact that I can feel like it's so packaged, so focused on the same five race leaders, trapped in amber, spiritless. But coming up, I'll talk with a historian about the origins of that package and what it was supposed to achieve. The history of Black History Month. That's next.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
What if millions of Black Americans had been compensated for slavery? Join me, Trymaine Lee, as I explore the untold story of one of the only Black Americans who ever was. I talk to his descendants and discuss how reparations forever changed their family's trajectory, and imagine a reality where reparations are paid to the rest of Black America. Into America presents Uncounted Millions, The Power of Reparations, a Black History Month series. New episodes drop Thursdays. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Depending on your age or just how much you've paid attention to this annual ritual, many of you probably know Black History Month as something that began in 1976. That's when President Ford made his first official national proclamation of it. But the history of Black History Month goes back many, many decades before that, and it is complicated. So to learn that history, we called up Dr. Peyro Dagbovi. He's a history professor and associate dean in the graduate school at Michigan State University. He's the author of many books, but perhaps the most notable bit of his work for our purposes is that he's the editor of the Journal of African American History. This journal was founded more than a century ago by the very man who initially imagined what would become today's Black History Month. Dr. Dagwavy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Kai, for having me.
So I alluded there in your introduction to the person who initially imagined what would become Black History Month. This is Carter G. Woodson. He's sort of known as the father of Black history. And I feel like he's one of those names, if you're a Black kid growing up in a home that does a lot around our history, as I did, Carter G. Woodson is up there in the first names you learn. So let's just linger on him as a person for a minute. Tell us about Carter Woodson. Who was he in the early 20th century, and what was his own origin story?
Yes, Carter Woodson has a very interesting origin story. Dr. Woodson was born in December of 1875 in Virginia, and he grew up in what could be considered as poverty on his father's farm, and he worked a range of manual labor jobs throughout his life. His parents were formerly enslaved, and as a child, he had to work for the household and the farm, so he only attended school for about 5 months out of every year. And he once remarked that he learned the fundamentals of reading, writing, and arithmetic in his late teens. And so he grew up struggling. There's a quote in 1920 from a letter that he wrote to Jesse Moreland where he said the following, quote, "You should know enough about me to understand that I am the most independently hungry man in the United States. I once drove a garbage wagon in my hometown, toiled for 6 years as a coal miner, often saw the day when my mother had her breakfast and did not know where she would find her dinner," end quote. So he grows up, you know, very poor and struggling, ends up going to high school in West Virginia, attends Berea College and graduates in 1903, goes on to get a master's degree from the University of Chicago in 1908, and then he goes to Harvard and receives a PhD in history in 1912, becoming the second African-American to du so after W.B. Du Bois did so in 1890s. And so he has a story that demonstrates rising over many, many obstacles. And I think that would inform his later life.
And he's as we can hear from that bio, he's a tenacious man, right?
Oh, I mean, indeed. Yes, he never lost that quote unquote working class ethos throughout his life. And I think that that's what kind of drove him to work 18-hour days for the cause of Black history as if it was a life and death struggle, as he always used to remark.
Well, so in the summer of 1915, he goes to a celebration of the 50th anniversary of emancipation in Chicago. So that's a few years after he's gone to Harvard. And, you know, it's worth pointing out there, we're not even a full adult life away from slavery and the Civil War here. That's important context.
Right.
And this is where he gets inspired to create something new. But before we get to that inspiration, first, tell us about this convening, this particular convening in Chicago that he was at. What was that like?
Well, the byproduct of that convening is the founding of a very important organization. The organization is called the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History. That's what it was called when it was founded in Chicago in 1915. And this organization was the first major organization to be dedicated to the study, the rigorous academic study of African-American life and history, as well as dedicated to the popularization of Black history amongst the quote-unquote masses of African-Americans. And so he creates this organization in Chicago with a handful of other folks, and the organization is still around today under a different name, of course. It's called the Association for the Study of African-American Life and History, and it is testimony to Carter G. Woodson being a Black institution builder. That is, he realized that he had to have an organization with a whole bunch of foot soldiers to kind of execute this plan of popularizing and legitimizing the study of Black history.
Tell me about that popularizing piece. So the point was he wanted to popularize it amongst Black people.
Yes. His dual cause, in my estimation, was number one, to legitimize the academic rigorous study of Black history within the academy. And he had the credentials, of course, to do so with a PhD from Harvard. So he wanted to establish a field, a rigorous field, with its own journal, with its own society, to combat the anti-Black stereotypes that existed in the United States historical profession during the Progressive Era. So that's one component. The other component, as you mentioned, was to popularize and democratize the study of Black history, where he wanted the masses of his people to know about their past. He wanted the masses of their people, especially children, to study their past so that they could gain inspiration from their ancestors and embark on a brighter future of accomplishments. He believed that one's social identity was inextricably bound to one's notion of his, her, or their past. And so those were the two main mantras of his movement. And he was a master, I think, at balancing both the perspectives and approaches simultaneously.
Well, it's interesting, though, to think about, you know, this idea of popularizing, making sure that Black children in particular were studying their past. Again, we're 50 years out of slavery at this point.
Right.
It's just kind of hard to wrap your head around that.
It is kind of hard to wrap one's head around it. And that's why he was a visionary, in my estimation. And he noticed that, you know, folks' social identity and self-esteem was very much linked to what they knew that their ancestors did or didn't do. I mean, if you're a young Black child coming of age during the era of Jim Crow segregation, and you're constantly told that your people have no history that's worth anything, it's easier for the oppressor to oppress someone by creating such a fallacy. And he wanted to challenge that and to have, you know, young people learn their history so that it, again, could be part of their day-to-day life and culture. And so that's what Negro History Week is actually part of, is his mass education movement that was multifaceted.
So let's back up a step there, because you mentioned Negro History Week, but let's walk through it. So he creates the organization. The organization creates a journal, which you now edit all these years later.
Yes.
And with one of these goals being to sort of get Black people in particular to know our history, to celebrate it. And he thinks, I guess, that people, the readers of it, are going to pick it up and run with it. And so did that happen right away? How did Black people respond?
Well, it took some time because, first of all, after he created the association, he made the decision to make it an open organization. It wasn't just for scholars. Okay, you did not have to have a bachelor's degree, a master's degree in history or any field to join the organization. It was open to all those in the Black community who wanted to join the organization and contribute to the organization so that he could disseminate information about African-American life and history. He started out by creating the Journal of Negro History in 1916, but it was more of a scholarly journal, and it wasn't accessible to the masses of people. So he kind of addressed that by creating his own publishing house. His publishing house was called Associated Publishers Incorporated, and he created that in the early 1920s, about 3 or 4 years before Negro History Week, to publish books that some of them were scientific, but the majority of them were written for the masses of people, including his famous book called The Negro in Our History, mm-hmm. which sold more than 40,000 copies by the early 1940s. And so he gradually, adopted this approach of increasingly popularizing Black history, even before Negro History Week was officially launched in 1926. Another thing that he did was open up a extension division or a home study program where he had leading scholars who would correspond with people who wanted to take courses, basic courses in Black history. And it's very much like today's, mm-hmm. E-learning movement in this era of COVID. He also would speak at various, engagements throughout the country, usually for free, just to pass the word. He would visit elementary schools, and he encouraged, communities across the country to create Black history clubs to help engage in the study of Black history at the community level.
So can we talk about the context in which he's doing all this work and his focus on, you mentioned the academic rigor and particularly this use of like scientific study, the scientific study of Black life and Black history. Why was that so important in this moment? Why the scientific distinction?
It's a very good question. And we have to keep in mind that he is operating as a historian after he gets his PhD in 1912 in the Progressive Era, right? During that period from the late 19th century through the early 20th century to the 1920s is when he's kind of coming of age as a historian. And it's during this time period that the United States historical profession is becoming professionalized. And there is not a space for African-American history within this U.S. historical profession. In fact, you know, leading historians at the time are saying that Black people have no history and that they're inferior. And most of the stuff that's being written about African-Americans in U.S. history is not positive. And so he had to engage in this kind of corrective history, if you will. He had to challenge the racist history that was being written about Black people that was being used to justify Black oppression. And he had to do that scientifically, because if he didn't, it wouldn't have been acknowledged as being rigorous. So if you go back and read the early issues of the Journal of Negro History, you will notice that the articles are densely footnoted, densely researched, that the journal actually resembles like the scholarship that's being produced by American historians who are in the American Historical Association. So he created this, what we call parallel institution, this institution to study Black history that ran parallel during the period of Jim Crow segregation to the mainstream or white stream institutions. So it was very important to have a seat at the table. And there's very few African Americans with PhDs across the border in history at this time. And so he used his Harvard training to battle for the cause of Black history within this U.S. historical space that was predominantly white male.
But I also wonder about, you know, that word scientific. I guess it makes me think about the dawn of eugenics at that time, you know,
yeah.
And this idea of whether or not Black people were actually human beings.
Right.
And I guess I wonder about that. Was there some degree of like trying to disprove that idea?
Oh. For sure. I mean, there's a lot of pseudoscientific evidence, quote unquote, that's lingering around at this time. And that scholarship that he's producing historically is seeking to totally upend that. And he's doing something that generations of Black historians who didn't have PhDs had been doing ever since the antebellum era, right? The earliest writers of Black history came of age during the period of slavery. They just didn't have the credentials of a PhD. Somebody like George Washington Williams, who is considered to be one of the first Black historians because he wrote scientific slash rigorous scholarship, is considered to be one of the first historians, but he didn't have the PhD. So when I'm using the word scientific, I'm also talking about the disciplinary methods of the field and of history at this time, where you're supposed to do certain type of research, you're supposed to examine historical documents and archives, you're supposed to cite your sources, you're supposed to make knowledge claims that have evidence. You're not just straight up making stuff up.
So he decides to create Negro History Week, ultimately, in February 1926.
Yes.
That's where all of this work culminates in.
Mm-hmm.
And as I understand it, there's some debate over why February, which I think all of us are wondering now. So I think it had something to do with the fact that both Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln had birthdays in February. But then like there's also we still sort of say it's the shortest month. So no wonder. what is why February? Why was it February?
Yeah, Dick Gregory always used to say that quote unquote, they gave us the shortest month. But yeah, you are correct that it was initiated during February in honor of the birthdays of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. And it's kind of a no-brainer why, you know, Woodson would celebrate Frederick Douglass. You know, for all that he did as a anti-slavery advocate and Black freedom fighter. And folks will probably question, well, why Abraham Lincoln? And I would argue that at the time, if you were to compare Abraham Lincoln's approach to Black people compared to other U.S. presidents, that his signing of the Emancipation Proclamation automatically put him in a different category, even though we know that the Emancipation Proclamation did not abolish slavery. That was accomplished by the 13th Amendment. But that's the reason why he chose February symbolically, is because of the birth dates of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. And I believe that he articulates that in an article, that is Woodson, that he wrote outlining the purpose and mission of Negro History Week.
Coming up, we'll learn how we got from Negro Achievement Week in 1924 to Black History Month now. We'll be right back. Hey, a program note, if you're into this episode, watch your feed for the next few weeks. We'll be following up with a couple more conversations about Black History Month and all of our relationships to it. And if you want something else to hear right now, go check out an episode we made about Ida B. Wells, who is another person I feel like we hear about during Black History Month, but who I don't think enough people actually know, like know her story and what she was about. There's a link to that episode in the notes for this one. You can find it in your podcast app or go to our website at wnyc.org/anxiety. Enjoy. Dr. Dagbavi, what about you? What's your own personal relationship to this month? I mean, obviously, you've dedicated your life's work to learning and promoting our history. But I mean, on a personal level, before, you know, if you can think back before you were Smarty Pants PhD and all the rest of it, like when did you start connecting to this history in general?
Well, I think like many people, they first learn about Black History Month when they're young and in school. And I remember, you know, going to school, whether it was middle school or high school, and February rolls around, and then all of a sudden, the information in your textbooks that's in the shaded box all of a sudden gets discussed, and then you'll see, you know, maybe a picture of Booker T. Washington, Langston Hughes, or some others up on the wall. And so that's how I first, you know, I think remember it. But as I became older, like maybe, you know, early in college years, I started to take it more seriously. And I recognized how it has been, how shall we say, commercialized and mainstreamed. But I also enjoyed having the opportunity to really spend some time, you know, during a certain month, celebrating. And I think that that's one of the challenges that we face today, is that many people have been questioning the validity of Black History Month. And I understand your concerns that you articulated. And there's a film called More Than a Month by Shukri Tillman, where he talks all about this, right? Where he questions, why do we still need this? Isn't this kind of archaic? And I think that there are ways that it can be improved and become more effectual in how it's delivered. And I think that that should really take place in the K-12 system. So I think it's here to stay, and I think that's a good thing. I just think that we have to revisit the past to see how effective it was back in the day and how we can perhaps build upon that.
Yeah. Let's go to Lex in Jamaica, Queens. Lex, welcome to the show. I understand you've got a question about Black History Month.
Thanks for inviting me, and thanks for having the show. So good evening. How do you think in our modern times that we can use education specifically around a Black identity and, you know, the aspects of our history which can hold us up to do that, to help inform the identity of Black children in particular? I'm a father of Black children and also Black children that are biracial. And I don't want them only to feel the weight of Blackness that we've overcome only the things that, you know, microaggressions down to the things that are just patently unfair that we all know of. I want them to know and understand, you know, the glories of what we've overcome rather than only being under the weight of what we still have to endure. I understand that this operates in the area of academia, but how can we take that into everyday lives and have that be more of an awareness that translates into a self-awareness, which translates into, you know, something that's more expansive and real.
Thank you, Lex. And, you know, and Dr. Dagbavi, if I can add to that, it sounds like really, you know, to put it in Carter Woodson's mind too, you know, did he think of this as a Black Pride project? That's what I'm hearing from Lex.
Yeah, he did think it was a Black Pride project. And that's a very good question that was raised. And it means a lot to me because I am the father of three young men now. They're all college age now. And I remember when they were in elementary and middle school, and the time that they would learn about Black history would be when there was discussions about slavery, when there was discussions about maybe the Harlem Renaissance in passing, and then when there were discussions about the civil rights movement. And when folks were talking about slavery and the civil rights movement, it was usually couched in oppression. So I think one of the things that we have to really keep in mind is that when we teach our youth about Black history, there has to be a delicate balance between themes of resistance and themes of oppression. We can't understand the accomplishments and the glory without understanding the monumental obstacles that have had to be overcome. And kids, you know, have high tolerance for understanding this stuff as long as we can break it down and keep it real with them. So I don't buy the excuse that there are certain things that we cannot share with our children. And there's a whole bunch of good children's book out there right now about Black history. There's a lot of good games that one can buy. And it means you got to walk through your kids with it and be ready to answer some difficult questions that should not be a yes or no response. History is very, very messy. And Woodson believed this as well, because what his goal was with Negro History Week was actually to integrate the study of Black history into the school systems, right?
Can you talk about that a little bit more? I mean, because it wasn't supposed to just be a week. It was supposed to be a catalyst for something more in schools.
Exactly. When he had Black History Week, he wanted it to evolve into Black History Year. But he knew in 1926 that there couldn't be some massive reform in the American educational system that would all of a sudden, you know, quote unquote, integrate the study of Black history throughout, you know, history and social science courses. So he wanted to use this week as kind of like a jump start. And he really focused on the children, and he focused on Black school teachers and schools to discuss Black history during that week intensely so that eventually it could linger on into other months. And it was aimed, as was said, in instilling a sense of pride and self-esteem in Black students. But at the same time, Woodson perhaps optimistically believed that if whites knew more about the achievements that Blacks had done over the years, that they might treat them more humanely, that they might not use justification of Black people not having a history to oppress them. So it was a social reform movement, if you will. It was a movement that had a lot of psychological ramifications to it. And I think that in today's world, knowledge of the past can definitely shape how people think. I mean, it does every day. History is with us every day. It's certainly part of our identity.
Certainly the premise of this show. But getting back to the origin story of the month, the week, Negro History Week, really took off, you know, and spread far and wide. I actually think we have a clip we can play of, by the time we get to 1956, here in New York City, it becomes declared Negro History Week by officially. So I think here is our mayor then, 1956, Robert Wagner, proclaiming Negro History Week in the city.
And whereas the observance of Negro History Week this year will fittingly culminate in a public tribute to those who accomplished through the highest tribunal a decision that indicates a successful attainment in American life.
And so I just play that little clip to ask you, you know, at what point did white people start to get on board with this? At what point did it become a thing that, you know, a white mayor of New York City would be proclaiming Negro History Week? I mean, this is still pre-civil rights movement.
Right. Thanks for playing that clip. That was really awesome. You know, it took off right away. And that's because Woodson and his colleagues used the radio. They used community centers. They had pageants. They had plays. They had speaker series. They were able to really publicize this throughout the community. And it wasn't only within the Black community that some of these events took place. It trickled into white communities as well, who saw the value in Carter Woodson's work. And so charting the evolution of it is kind of difficult. But if it starts in 1926, and that clip you played was from 1956, it shows you that within a couple decades, you have, you know, politicians at the local level of big cities who are acknowledging this. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that New York City at this time, I'm sure, had a branch of the association there, and mm-hmm. they were also probably putting some pressure on folks to acknowledge it. And so that's why Woodson created this large umbrella organization that had branches in all the major cities, so that these different branches would take up the mantle of celebrating Negro History Week through all these different areas throughout the country. And so, yeah, it was something that was picked up gradually throughout the country. And it largely depended upon, in many cases, the Black population within those cities.
Mm-hmm. Let's squeeze in one more question from callers. Deacon in Harlem. Deacon, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you very much. First of all, I just want to say how much I appreciate the show, and I appreciate you, Doctor. And I just want to make a brief comment, if I may, on the importance of Black History Month. I'm one of those. I'll be 86 in February this coming, and my first 6 years, I say my first 12 years were totally Black. And I was, although born in Philadelphia, I was raised in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. So all of my teachers, from first to sixth grade, they all looked like me. And I can remember about third grade being introduced to what was called Negro history. We had a little primer. And I know the name Carter G. Woodson. We knew those names. We knew about the NAACP. We studied history, European history, history of the state, North Carolina, and Negro history. And in the community that I was raised in, we didn't pick cotton, although we had professional farmers, but they all were blue-collar workers working in the tobacco factories of Winston-Salem. So I can appreciate that history. So that when I came to New York, I saw readily the contradiction of what the racism was. And unfortunately, many of my classmates, although we went to Catholic school, they didn't have the understanding that I had of who I was. You know, I can appreciate that.
Thank you so much for that comment. And Dr. Dagbavi, in these last few minutes, I guess one of the things that I want to ask you about is where this all went, because pretty quickly, actually, Carter G. Woodson got frustrated with it. He started talking about charlatans and the like who were preaching it. What was he frustrated with?
Well, he was frustrated with the fact that there were different people who started to capitalize on the popularity of this commemoration and people who started to make money off of it. And he got upset with that because the movement was not to make money for individuals. The movement was to, you know, raise the consciousness of people about Black history. And if any money was to be made, it was to go back into the association, because the association was like a mutual aid society. The association did not make a whole lot of money off of its marketing of Black history and its celebrating of Black history. All the money that went back into the association sustained its mass education movement and research trajectory. So he got frustrated with those people who he called silver-tongued orators who came into the community during Black History Month days and claimed that they knew about Black history and would make money off of it. And he spoke out about that a whole lot. And he did not want people not to be down with the cause. He literally lived Black history every moment of his life and believed that if he didn't do what he did, that African-American people would have been ideologically exterminated. That's how he took his cause of Black history.
Dr. Peiro Dagbavi is a history professor and associate dean at the Graduate School of Michigan State University and the editor of the Journal of African-American History, which was created more than a century ago by Carter G. Woodson. I'm Kai Wright. Thanks for spending this time with us. Happy Black History Month. United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Jared Paul mixed the podcast version. Kevin Bristow and Matthew Miranda were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Emily Botine, Ginny Casas, Marianne McCune, Christopher Wirth, and Vera Lynn Williams. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Karen Frillman is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And, of course, I hope you will join us for the live version of the show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker, play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening and take care of yourselves.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.